is really one of the most patiently researched contributions to our understanding of what is loosely referred to around the academic water cooler as a corporate university. And praise for the book aside, I also want to argue that it presents only one half of the story, and one of my concerns is that we're not paying enough attention to the other half of the story, which I won't grace with the name academic corporation, although some of you may be tempted to do so. The fact is that we're very fond of our siege mentality in the academy, our academic siege mentality, which only sees new developments in terms of threats and assaults upon us, our customs and our traditions. And we can only see our own workplaces being invaded by corporate management strategies and the logic of market optimization and so on and so forth. We don't see often that the traffic goes in both directions. We know very little about the corporate world, and therefore we don't see how the mentality and the customs of academic life is also being transplanted at a very rapid rate into knowledge industry workplaces. These are firms where research is increasingly conducted along lines that might be familiar to us and where the work tempo is also somewhat strikingly familiar. In other words, workplaces where ideas, collaboration and research and ideas is the industrial stock in trade, where employees are encouraged to speak and think freely for reasons of profit, and where employees no longer know when they're on or off the job at any waking time of the day. It's unfamiliar. So the truth of the matter is, and I think we need more attention to this, is that I think we're living through the formative stages of a new mode of production, which is marked by a quasi-convergence of the research university and the knowledge corporation, each of them mutating into new species in tandem with one another. Both sectors display similar kinds of organization when it comes to things like capitalization around IP, intellectual property, work tempo, and also stratification of their workforces around a core of secure, indispensable brain workers on the one hand, and a vast army of precarious labor contingent and intermittent employees on the other hand. Nelson Lichtenstein has argued that Walmart is the what he calls a template of 21st century capitalism, and there's certainly a case to be made for that in the realm of production, distribution, and consumption of goods. I would argue that the counterpart in the sectors in which we work lies somewhere in the physiognomy of this sort of evolving hybrid species of the knowledge employee, kind of Schumpeterian creative entrepreneur who very soon will feel at home on both the high-tech corporate campuses and on academic campuses. Now, that's not to say we don't have a problem with corporatization in the academy. Of course, we do. One of our advantages, however, is that it's relatively easy to see it coming. Because all of the ideas, the corporate management ideas that are imported into our workplaces are already old ideas in corporate America. There's probably something like a 15-year time lag between, you know, the rollout in the corporate world and then when our administrators adopt these strategies. And the outcome is often difficult to predict. Let me give you one local example. NYU faculty recently all received a lengthy email from our president about how the administration intends to respond to the burgeoning economic crisis, or recession, or whatever you call it. Last time around this happened, 2002, the response came in the form of a freeze on faculty salaries. This time around, it's called administrative reengineering. If you think the catchphrase reengineering sounds familiar, or suspiciously like a management fad from the early 1990s, you're dead right. Hammer and Chompy's Reengineering the Corporation was a 1993 best-selling Bible of the whole executive crusade to slash the ranks of middle management in order to create these lean and mean corporate organizations that could respond very quickly and efficiently to market changes. And sure enough, if you work your way through the very solid prose of the recent NYU email, the message is quite clear. If I were a middle manager at NYU, I'd be looking out for my job. Now, some of you might think there's some justice here. A report published a few weeks ago declared that administrators now outnumber faculty in the U.S. academic sector. But my point is that the belatedness of this import is fairly typical. On the other side of the story, you can say that knowledge-based firms are, of course, they're very early movers. They're very efficient at capturing the latest academic research techniques, by contrast with our administrators. They generally do so through industry-funded research in a variety of disciplines that is sort of organized into the framework of intellectual property licensing. In Washburn's book, we learn how knowledge is privatized upstream under this new generation of intellectual property agreements. Consequently, the lessons that are gleaned from cutting-edge research don't make it downstream. They don't make it into the public domain, which is a traditional model of academic exchange and indeed the lifeblood of academic freedom as we know it. In response, however, I would point out that managers in knowledge firms are also well aware of their need to be able to borrow freely from the public domain. Indeed, their profits depend on such free inputs, just as they stand to benefit from the fluid circulation of high-skilled brain workers within their industrial sectors. And in many high-tech firms, an open speech environment is actively encouraged, along with institutional self-criticism, but it's very far removed from Taylorist work disciplines. Now, I'm not suggesting these are exact corporate equivalents of what we traditionally regard as academic freedom, but they are efforts. However driven by profit hunger, they are efforts to emulate academic work mentality and its customs. Moreover, as these efforts seem to be advancing in industry, what we regard as traditional academic freedom is declining in higher education. We know that for the growing army of contingent faculty, academic freedom is really little more than a mirage in the desert. And as a result of casualization, we're now up to almost a third of all faculty. Only a third of all faculty are now in the tenure stream. At NYU, 72% of the teaching workforce is now off the tenure track. There are very few knowledge-based workplaces where the shrinkage of the secure core is so transparent and where the rate of casualization has been so rapid. It's unprecedented in any profession. But it's not just the numbers, of course. It's the allocation of benefits, privileges, and rewards, which really starkly reveal the gulf between the secure tenure core, some of which are paid million-dollar salaries and hold very lucrative shares in IP licenses and their research, and the part-time majority, many of whom qualify for food stamps and have no access to an office. I'm not kidding, you do. Not surprisingly, it's adjunct faculty and graduate teachers who've taken the lead in organizing and bargaining, and they are at the moral center of the academic labor movement, insofar as we can talk about an academic labor movement. They have been the most active practitioners. On some campuses, they've been able to extract support, sympathy, commitment from full-time faculty on the basis of their predicament, their principles, their ideas for organizing, but it has not been easy going. And the apathy of tenured faculty, tethered as they are to the individualized reward system, is not only a formidable obstacle, it's also a very shameful reflection on a professional elite that holds the privilege of academic freedom but will not use it to protect those who are excluded on a daily basis. Now, most of the talk, well, a little bit of the talk around the academic water cooler these days is about the emergence of the transnational and the global university. This stampede on the part mostly of Anglophone universities to set up shop overseas, to expand offshore, as it were. And the questions that come up really are fairly basic questions. Whether this development will augment and hasten on a lot of the trends workforce trends we've been seeing in the academic sector, whether it'll have the same impact on the rate of casualization, whether we'll see a further erosion of academic governance, whether we'll see a further concentration of power upwards into senior administrative ranks, whether, in short, the global university will in some way emulate the operations of the global corporation. I think it's too early to say whether that be the case, although some of you might argue there's already evidence on the ground to support that hypothesis. At NYU, which is no slouch when it comes to entrepreneurial conduct, we have a particular case study at hand, NYU in Abu Dhabi. The NYU venture in Abu Dhabi has been described as the first comprehensive liberal arts campus to be operated abroad by a major U.S. research university, and is a topic of much conjecture conversations between faculty, between faculty and administrators, and so on and so forth over the last year. And a good deal of the skeptical talk about this venture, which is entirely a top-down, it's not a faculty-driven venture, it's entirely top-down understanding between our president, Crown Prince in Abu Dhabi. A good deal of the skeptical talk has been about free speech issues in the Emirates, and I've been struck by how seldom these concerns are linked in conversation to the principle of tenure. I hardly need to remind this audience that the primary reason for the existence of tenure is to guarantee academic freedom. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to justify tenure as an employment contract otherwise, especially to a general public for whom job security is withered so drastically and rapidly. Evaporated almost. So if you were setting up an autonomous campus overseas with NYU's name on it, you would imagine the first thing to secure would be a plan for a permanent tenured faculty who could guarantee faculty governance over academic affairs and its role in the shared governance of the institution and, you know, all these good AUP things. And yet, this seems to be an afterthought in the planning for this campus. As far as we can figure out, the teaching workforce will consist of a combination of faculty flown over from here, if they can be persuaded to go over there on temporary tours of duty, and a vast teaching workforce over there of contract labor from the region or from South Asia. Whichever way you cut it, it's likely to be a tenure-free university or campus. And if it is to be the first of its kind, then it will be a disastrous model to follow. What's more surprising, however, is how few faculty I've heard express particular concern about this. You know, a lot of concern about free speech issues, but hardly any concern about these issues of governance and tenure, which guarantee academic freedom. What do you make of that? Well, is it an indication of how far consciousness about faculty governance has fallen? Or is it a reflection of how far our expectations of seeing any effective faculty governance have fallen? These are good questions to ponder. In terms of active response, I have to report that the AUP chapter on campus has asked the national AUP leadership to work on a statement regarding the upholding of basic AUP principles regarding tenure and governance in the case of U.S. universities operating overseas. And I believe this will be discussed at the next meeting of Committee A in June, so there are a few people in this room who will be involved in that discussion. It's striking to me that the AUP has not hitherto seen fit to debate how its foundational principles are to be observed and or violated on these overseas campuses, but the statement will be a good beginning and a timely one at a moment when fiscally squeezed universities are rushing to take advantage of the lucrative offers that are being made by overseas by overseas entities, in the same way that corporations have responded to the kind of discount-laden invitations to come and invest that managers of free trade zones make on a daily basis. There's a little more to report, however, and I'll just conclude with this. Faculty are notoriously blind to the rights and conditions of other kinds of campus employees. And in the construction of NYU Abu Dhabi, we have an opportunity, really, to address this issue, to somehow do the right thing. As I'm sure you're aware, exploitation and abuse of migrant workers is legion in the Emirates, in the region, and is especially pronounced in the construction industry. And Human Rights Watch has documented the systematic abuse and has tried without success to persuade two other brand-name cultural institutions, the Louvre and the Guggenheim, to guarantee fair labor conditions to the workers who are building their outposts on Saadiyat Island, which is a cultural district where NYU will also be. So we've been working, the AUP again here in campus has been working with student groups and the Human Rights Watch to adapt a code of conduct that will regulate the university's relationship with all the contractors involved in the construction and maintenance of the campus over there. And the code is adapted from the model code of the Workers' Rights Consortium, which was the sort of institution that was set up by the anti-sweatshop movement to protect workers involved in the manufacture of garments and other goods that bear university logos. So here's a question I want to end with. What is the relationship between these two initiatives? On the one hand, the faculty, the sort of AUP statement style issues about tenure and governance, and on the other hand, the code of conduct for migrant workers in the region. What do the rights of on-site migrant workers have to do with the exercise of academic freedom, and vice versa? For some folks, the answer will be obvious. They either have nothing to do with one another, or they have everything to do with one another. For other folks, the ethical terrain is a little more complicated, and then there will always be a large number of pragmatists who will say that if you want to change anything, you have to choose your battles. And indeed, I've been struck by how many pragmatists have responded in conversations I've been overhearing about this issue. I happen to think there's not a contradiction between the two. I mean, if the general public can be moved to express concern about the conditions under which retail garments are made, and the evidence is that they can and do, one could reasonably expect faculty to care about the conditions under which their classrooms are built and their offices cleaned. Academic freedom, I grant you, is a different beast from the consumer's freedom to choose sweat-free garments. But if you abstract academic freedom from the social conditions under which it's exercised, which make it possible, then you're left with the thinnest kind of laissez-faireism, what in other circumstances one might describe as rights without responsibilities. Now, before you leap to the conclusion that I'm advocating that we attach conditions to the exercise of academic freedom, let me assure you that I am, as much as anyone, a stomach pump fundamentalist when it comes to upholding those rights. But I don't think that belief should hold us back from reflecting on the cost to others by which these rights are maintained. And what we have now is a landscape of work in which the rights of a shrinking minority are effectively enabled and secured by the precarious labor of this sort of army of disenfranchised, part-time, deprofessionalized graduate teachers and a panoply of subcontracted, casualized service workers who are blue-collar, pink-collar, and white-collar now. And this is not a sustainable environment and will not be sustainable unless those of us who